hi everybody, welcome to another Woke Salaryman podcast episode. I lost count whatever number it is, so it's just the
I
next
think
one.
I got 12 or something.
Yeah, and today it's really cool because we have another guest with us. This is Wei Fook, and Wei Fook is the Chief Investment Officer at the biggest bank in Singapore, basically DBS. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate.
Yeah, so being a chief investment officer, to me as a layman, it just means he knows a lot of things about investments. And I think, especially to laymen like me, investing can be a very murky and difficult topic to navigate. So I was hoping like during this podcast, we could ask you some like questions that I also a bit scared sometimes to ask financial experts. But on this basis, I can, without shame, ask you my stupid questions.
Certainly.
Right. Maybe just to start off, how does one become a chief investment officer?
Oh, so my life story. I studied sciences in junior college, and because of that, I enrolled myself to an engineering course. But having graduated in 1987, which was not the best of times because recession hit Singapore, so I could not find a job. So accidentally got myself into the world of finance. So I started with the government of Singapore Investment Corp, which is really the sovereign wealth fund that manages all your CPF monies and all the reserves of the country. That's where I kind of learned the trick of the trade, so to speak. Yeah. You kind of start on a right footing, you know, you get to be exposed to global markets, various asset classes, bonds, equities, you know, foreign exchange.
Wait, but what kind of engineering?
So I did civil and structural engineering at the NUS.
Also, it's very different from finance, right?
Yeah, because you told us just now you worked at a construction site for a while. You want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so I mean, it's for us to graduate as a, you know, in engineering, we need to do an industrial attachment, and that would involve building flyovers, building bridges, and I happen to be involved in one of them for that 3 to 4 months of attachment.
So you graduate in 1987, and you try this thing for 3 or 4 months, then you're like, I don't really like it. Then you went to finance.
Yeah.
And then you work at like a sovereign wealth fund.
That's right.
Like a GIC or something.
Yes.
But your right. LinkedIn only started in 2017. I was looking just now. So, yeah. So I thought like, is it before that you were unemployed until 2017? Then, haha. CIO.
Yeah, straight away CIO, right?
But no, like, it's not like. Not,
no, no, no. It's okay. A long process, okay. Obviously. Yeah.
But so you were never really into civil engineering for a long time?
No, never was.
Was that your passion or something? Why civil engineering, actually?
Well, I'm quite comfortable with math. So I thought, without much proper career guidance, unfortunately, so the obvious choice then was to do engineering. And I thought that was a good foundation for finance, for investment-related profession, because I think the foundation, you know, on mathematics, including sciences, did help a lot. You know, so when we analyze markets and this and that, you tend to be more methodical. As an engineer, you kind of develop that discipline or skill set.
Also, you're also bringing that engineering discipline to the way you approach some of your
I think so. Inevitably, I think that had helped, you know, in terms of how you analyze situations. Obviously, in finance, it's all not about science. It's also about that element of art, you can call it. But science is a prerequisite, right? Before you make a call on a certain market.
Yeah.
Actually, it's true to a certain degree, because I know a lot of engineers who become finance people. Like, they do the transition, like, seemingly quite well. And they also become IT, they go to tech quite easily also. But I don't know why they all want to leave engineering. Maybe you can shed more light on it.
Well, I think some of my, you know, classmates who continue on as engineers, but it's quite a challenging job now, you know, given the fact that, you know, there was a wave of what we call outsourcing to other countries, cheaper, you know, countries to do manufacturing. So therefore, you know, your job is also under a bit of
disruption.
Disruption, yeah.
Also, in 1987, you already started already this outsourcing.
It kind of began accelerating in the 1990s or early 2000s.
We were only born in the 1990s, you know. So late 1980s, okay. You give me a look there. The strategy for Singapore and sort of the industries that we emphasize have changed. I say we, but I'm Malaysian, right? But You know, so it used to be like, Ren Ming was telling me like, it used to be like manufacturing, like even your dad was working at a tea factory at one point.
So last time
right?
Singapore managed foodstuffs. Then later other country managed foodstuffs also. But then they do it cheaper, ma. So we gotta
move on.
So to move up the value chain. So I think Singapore has done well in terms of moving up the value chain in across many sectors of the economy. Like in the area of manufacturing, you go into chips, you know, which is more difficult a product to manufacture. And then we also build ourselves an ecosystem around petrochemical
refinery.
That has been a very good, I would say.
That's Ren Ming's favorite term now, I think, nowadays.
Value chain.
Yeah, he talks about it all the time.
It's quite interesting because no one thinks of like petrochemical actually manufacturing, but you are manufacturing like fuel, so that definitely counts.
That's right.
And he talks about it in terms of like how you're saying like Singapore's moving up the value chain. Like Ren Ming just loves to talk about on the individual level moving up the value chain. So as much as the world moves, you know, we as individuals with agency, we also try to change to what the world wants as well.
Yeah.
And you seem to have done that.
And the world is changing very, very fast.
Yeah, faster than ever before, right?
Faster than ever before. For example, you know, I was just thinking about the speed of launching a certain product. For example, you know, these days, if you're Zoom in Silicon Valley, you launch the Zoom video app, immediately your total addressable market is the world, almost on an overnight basis.
That has
huge and profound implications on investing.
Like we were looking at, for one article that we talked about this point also, we're looking at basically, they use the rate of adoption in terms of like US households. So they're looking at stuff like, you know, telephone, refrigerator, all these like big technological things. And it used to be much lower. Like to achieve like 80% adoption in all households, it would take like years. Yes. And like you said, like Zoom and things like, you know, TikTok and things like that, when they come nowadays, it's like overnight, you know, it can just explode and 90% of people use it already.
Yeah, and they need not even have physical presence anywhere else in the world. Overnight,
the
total
tech, right?
Addressable market is the world because of cloud computing tech.
So maybe let's move back to like investment also. Like, what is a chief investment officer? Because in my mind, it's just like, is it like all the DBS money is on one account, then you will sit in a computer and trade? That's not what it is.
I think that's very stressful.
So we actually provide what we call investment services. So we either manage our clients' money, they park money with us, we ask them, oh, what's your risk profile? Oh, I can take some risk, so then we will manage a portfolio according to that risk profile. And in some cases, we provide advisory on, oh, you should be doing this and that. They make the decision. So that's called an advisory service. There's also a discretionary service whereby we manage on their behalf. So that's how we help and guide.
But that's the whole investment arm of DBS. But what do you as a CIO, like what is your sort of duties and what do you do?
So I have a team that help to create or originate these kind of investment ideas, strategies. We generate investment trends and ideas. You know, oh, what should you be investing in? For example, you know, you should be buying winners of the cloud computing sector. We identify the trend. We say, oh, the next big trend is the world becoming a digital economy. Who are the winners in this? Oh, it has to be the infrastructure companies that provide, you know, cloud, be it, you know, the likes of Microsoft with Azure or Amazon with AWS. It could be the, you know, companies that provide software as a service, you know, the Adobe's,
Salesforce
and all that. So that's how we would advise, oh, this is the long-term, we call it secular trend, long-term irreversible growth
secular
trend.
Secular trend, what do you call it then?
Secular means long, very long, and it's a non-reversible trend.
I see.
So secular is a non-religious.
That's what I was thinking as well.
Sure. There is a secular could mean non-religious as well. But in this case, it's something that is going to change for a long time to come, right? So this particular trend, the world becoming a digital economy, we all can feel it, and it's happening all across the segments of society, from young to old. And who are the champions, who are the winners of this secular trend? That's how we would then help our clients to say, hey, invest in all this.
Who are we before CIO?
So I used to be a portfolio manager.
Yeah.
am still a portfolio manager as a CIO, but I used to manage money in different asset classes. Bonds. I started with bonds, and then later on with multi-asset portfolios, including stocks.
So before portfolio, you are probably like an analyst.
Yeah. So you most likely would have to start off as an analyst.
Okay. So what would you say, right? Like separates a CIO from, let's say, a middle management portfolio manager.
Yeah.
Like, let's say if somebody wants to be.
Just an investment officer.
No. If somebody wants to be CIO, right? What are the skills needed that is different from what a portfolio manager?
Right. So normally a portfolio manager or an analyst would specialize on a certain asset class.
Mm.
So most likely you are an equity analyst. So
a commodities person.
Or commodities,
Right.
And then within equity, you could possibly be, I'm a technology analyst, or I'm a Singapore REITs analyst. Mm. So you kind of specialize on one area of focus. In the case of bonds, you could be someone who's very familiar with Asian bonds, or someone who's very familiar with they call it high yield, you know, bonds. But then a CIO would be someone who is able to, number one, look across asset classes, have a good understanding, a good feel, because different asset classes do move differently at different times of the economic cycle. So CIO therefore can identify which is, number one, the best asset class for this period of the cycle, you know, and then advise or buy more of these kind of assets.
Also, it's like very macro and long term.
Well, macro is important, but you need to have bottom up, you know, capabilities or competencies as well.
Yeah.
For example, we are seeing a lot of what we call bifurcation. You know, you can say that U.S. is undergoing a lot of problems on a macro basis, right?
Yes.
Inflation, and they've been borrowing a lot, the debt is very high, so let's not buy U.S. stocks. But that's very macro. But then if you look underneath, you find that actually within the U.S. market, there are big, big winners. Like technology is one, right? So if you look at the most innovative companies in the world, most of them are in the U.S. So really, it's not just macro, and then you conclude.
So it's not just you see the big picture, then decide as a whole, because this seems to not be, because there are also like sometimes micro opportunities within that macro thing. Right?
That's right. So yeah, micro opportunities, micro trends, and there's a price for everything.
Yes.
You know, the stock market can be down because you're going through a period of difficulty on a macro perspective, but already priced in, probably already priced in into the share price. So there is a price for everything. Every dog has his day. So never write off anything, you know?
Right.
I think we saw this last year, you know. I think last year we created some content about bonds. Last year, I think like the crypto use were really high. Bonds are dead. Bonds are dead. Like, who invests in bonds? Like, bonds are for losers.
Yeah.
That was the right call last year. So then, bonds,
You can't write off the whole asset class forever, right? Then this year,
3% SSP.
So now you can actually have a portfolio of high grade bonds, you know, that means very low default rate and pays you 5%.
Yeah.
So suddenly, you know, there is life. There is a reason now to be involved in
bonds. Like oil also, you know, before the war, it was like you had to. It was like negative price or something, per barrel, you know.
So $40 everyone was writing off oil because of this focus on, you know, ESG, and oil stocks were likened as tobacco stocks.
Yes, and also because the COVID, then everybody's consumption went down a bit.
Yeah.
You know, so it seems like there was no demand for it. And then, bang, you know, climate, and then the war, and
And crazy. The lack of production. So that resulted in undersupply.
Mm.
Of all, so every dog has its day.
Yes.
Never write off anything. There's a price for everything. So the role of the CIO is to determine, you know, what we call opportunities. Given the price today, am I buying this particular asset or this particular stock where there is margin of safety? You know, Warren Buffett likes to use this phrase, margin of safety, which means that even if I don't get the timing right, I know there is intrinsic value in this stock based on my forecast of all the cash flows that this company will generate. I then calculate the fair value, and if the share price today is below fair value, then I know there is margin of safety. Even if I'm not right with the timing, I know it's going to be supported. Mm.
So that's what a CIO does. Is there any like change in job scope compared to like your last job? Like, do you talk to like upper management a bit more? Like, for example, do you hang out with like Piyush or something? Like, do you all go for like kopi in the morning?
So these days, the interesting thing about the internet is that there is what we call a democratization of views. And so you can actually follow all these movers and shakers of markets through
Twitter,
YouTube,
LinkedIn.
So, and that's a good thing, because I think that playing field has been leveled. In the past, you only get access if you're a huge fund manager. And of course, the means of sharing that information is so accessible these days on social media platforms and what have you. So the playing field is leveled now. And to be successful, even as an individual investor, it's there. You just do your homework. You got to do your homework.
Yeah.
And you got to follow certain disciplines.
I'm talking about retail investor.
I'm talking about retail. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can be as good as an institutional investor today, but you have to be following certain disciplines. And what Warren Buffett, you know, you read his quotes. There's a lot of wisdom in that. The latest one being, you know, I think Jeff Bezos, you know, the founder of Amazon, asked him, why is it Buffett, Warren, that you make so much money when your investing principles are so easy to understand? And you know what was Buffett's reply to him? Because everyone wants to make money quickly. I make money slowly. So you follow that discipline and you look at investing as a marathon, I don't think you go too far off.
I think it's
being successful.
I think it's definitely hard to be disciplined, especially last year.
Oh, especially last 2 years, so hard. Eh.
Everyone posting like, you know, like 80-90% gains.
Yeah.
But have you ever like not have discipline before?
Obviously, you know, I make a lot of mistakes on my own personal account as well.
Oh, yeah, own personal account. I cannot say
anything. Yeah. We all learn from mistakes. How you become successful is you live through all these cycles, not forgetting the crisis periods, not forgetting the lessons of the crisis, not forgetting your own mistakes.
Yeah.
Right? So if I look at my own investment portfolio, I've got two. One, more trading oriented, you know, every day, opportunity here, buy and then sell. And then I have another one which is longer term. We call it the SRS portfolio. You know,
SRS?
Supplementary retirement scheme.
Whereby, isn't that the government thing?
Yeah, it's the government thing.
Whereby you could put in a certain amount every year. For that amount that you put in, you're not taxed.
Not sponsored by SRS.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is that if I compare this to over like 20 years since SRS started, the SRS account has done a lot better than my trading account. Yeah. Why? Because it's long term. You're not trading in and out. There's truth in it that long term, if you have that as your investment time horizon, half the battle is won.
Right.
There's like a saying, like wealth is like a bar of soap. The more you touch it, the less it becomes. Yeah, less it becomes.
So don't touch the bar of soap.
Yeah.
There is some truth in that. Like, don't be too close, because there are a lot of noises in the market.
A lot, yeah.
And you tend to be swayed by noises.
And I think people don't like to admit that they don't know. You know, so a lot of times, even though like Warren Buffett also say, like he just recommends your retail investors to just, you know, SP 500, or just do index funds and don't touch it. But you know, doing that and not touching it requires that you understand that I don't know everything. And sometimes that's like not very nice to admit.
Yeah,
you
know? I think there are also nuances that one has to be cognizant of. For example, I think a lot of us, we grew up with this financial investment literature that says equities always outperform bonds. But if you think about it, who are the people who are writing these kind of principles? They are all referring to the American stock market. And if you apply that same to other markets, it may not be true. If you apply that to Japan, it's not going to be true. But somehow, in the case of US, it is. Why? For a number of reasons. The American stock market is the deepest, the broadest. It has the best of class companies there. And that's why, like what Warren Buffett would say, the American market is like an ATM machine. it keeps spewing out cash. And that's true. Because the companies there are super competitive, globally competitive, and they have presence all over the world.
I think it's something to be said because America can constantly attract the best talent, right? And I think
obviously
to be successful, but they'll say, like, oh, let's go to the US and start something.
The land of opportunity, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the people who are running the big companies in the US, they are multinational, right?
Mm.
You've got who's Nadella is running Microsoft. The founder of Google is Sergey Brin.
Mm, mm.
So yeah, you're right to say that innovation is a function of talent.
Mm. And I think the US for the last 20 years they were very open to talent. Like a lot of some of their biggest entrepreneurs today are all immigrants.
That's right. That's
but I think also the results that when the very successful immigrants move over, there was a hollowing out of like the middle class, like, because the inequality started to happen there as well.
Yeah, so it's true, it's true. I mean, capitalism has resulted in wealth growing, but unfortunately there is also this huge gap between rich and poor in the process.
There's this question we get quite often on our page, and it's like, what would happen if the S&P 500 falls to zero?
Oh yeah, this is one of the stupid questions that we want to ask.
Yeah.
We had a few of these
close calls,
occasions before 1987 when I first started.
I mean, maybe you can list all the collapses you have seen.
Okay, I started in 1987 and very soon after we had this, what we call Black Monday, the October crash. I think S&P Dow Jones went down like 30%.
Yikes.
But then if you look at the long-term chart now, it's just a tiny blip. Right? Then we had, for example, the Asian financial crisis, 1997. There is the Nikkei crash, late 1980s. There is, of course, the great financial crisis in 2008-2009. And having seen all these crises and managed money throughout all these years, one lesson I kind of learned from it is there is nothing new under the sun.
Right.
It's all driven by two things, greed and fear. Greed is always in the form of leverage, be it leverage on, you know, all kinds of products.
Leverage meaning like investing with things I don't have, right?
Over-borrowing.
Right.
So when there's excessive leverage, you would expect one day it will revert to the mean now. Collapse to the mean, yeah.
Do you feel like that happened to crypto last year?
Yeah, crypto is it's a bubble, clearly on hindsight.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of things do not appear like it's a bubble until the collapse happened.
Yeah.
It's very hard to time. I think there has been a fair amount of leveraging on crypto, right? People were borrowing in crypto to buy other cryptos.
People lending also to earn a lot of interest rates.
Stake, right?
Staking, yeah.
Staking, right? So the writing was on the wall. But we never, it's very difficult to predict the exact top.
Of course. Is there any signs of a bubble that you think people can spot?
I mean, Michael Burry has been saying forever that ETF is a bubble, right?
Other than Michael Burry.
So, yeah, Michael Burry talks about a bubble in ETF. And really, a bubble happens when there's excessive capital inflow into a certain asset class or a certain narrow segment of the market. I would respectfully disagree with Michael Burry, because actually ETFs are not narrowly focused investments. They are actually very broad-based.
Yeah.
By and large, all ETFs, like if I buy an ETF on S&P, it's a very broad market, right? So you're
is that a formal definition of bubble, that it has to be a narrow thing?
So normally when it's a narrow segment of the market and there's a lot of money going in, the valuations get inflated many times over. So then it's a bubble. The S&P is a broad index, so
by nature it doesn't fulfill this bubble definition.
It could, but just that a bubble would be, say for example, in 1999, a lot of money went into technology, NASDAQ, and it traded at 200 times price to earnings. That is a bubble, right?
Mm.
So not dissimilar to what we have seen of late too. If you look at, again, NASDAQ, there is one part of the NASDAQ market where all these companies are not profit-making.
Pre-revenue companies.
Yeah, so you would see the index for these non-profitable tech companies falling from the peak 80% as of now. Yeah, so bottom line is, we need to buy companies that has
a business model, revenue model that's sustainable, that's growing.
Mm.
We have moved from being, you know, from greed to fear now.
Yeah.
So the good thing about what had happened, obviously, it was very challenging in the first 8 months. Everything came down, right?
Maybe it's still challenging for some people.
Mm. Yeah, stocks come down. Normally, in the past, when stocks come down, bonds, high-grade government bonds would do well. But this time around, it too fell, and fell by a large margin.
Mm.
What is good is that now we are seeing things have normalized. So instead of a deposit rate at 0.25%, we are getting 3% today.
Mm.
Instead of bonds at 2.5%, you're getting 5% high-quality bonds. So I think things have normalized. Going forward, we are not in a bubble now, for sure. And valuations have all come down, even in the stock market. So I think, you know, barring short-term events, I think the longer-term trajectory, I think we are more at the fear
Yeah. Can I just bring it back to Michael Burry again? So one of the arguments that for Michael Burry's like index fund bubble, right, is that he says that people buy S&P 500 because it is the S&P 500. So I think the phrase he uses is, it is the tail wagging the dog instead of the dog wagging the tail.
Or meaning people are buying it not because of they are perceiving that the valuation is below fair, what the intrinsic value is.
They just buy because it's the S&P 500. And I think that's where the fear that a bubble happens. Well, what do you think of that?
Yeah, there is some element of, I would say, speculation, right?
Yeah.
The more the stock market goes up, the more speculative money goes in, right? And that results in overvaluation. I think that's what he was referring to. Everyone's talking about it, so...
Because personally, that's why I buy S&P 500. Honestly, I don't go and do the calculations to determine what I see as the intrinsic value. I'm using it as a way of like reducing the amount of money that I give to fund managers, and then I'm just buying the index myself.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a diversion away from certain other funds into the ETF, right? So to me, that's not additional money going into the S&P 500. Hence, I don't think it's a bubble. It's just the same pool of money, but it's just diverted away from, say, active mutual funds to ETFs.
But is it as a result then overvalued? Because there are a lot of people like me, for example, who are, I would say, ignorant, buying it without actually from a valuation POV, you know? I'm just buying it because it's the S&P 500.
So now, at this stage, it has corrected in terms of valuation, so it's not frothy anymore. But if there is one index or stock market index that you want to buy, it would be the S&P, because it has all the best world-class companies.
Right.
What do you think of the STI ETF? So, because every time we recommend people, because I invest in the STI ETF.
Yeah, also.
Right. Then every time online people, there will be like people commenting, oh yeah, Rimming is so stupid, you know, you invest in the STI ETF. And then I'm like, huh, but it's important to have diversification to local index here. Yeah. Like, why do you think people will still invest in the STI ETF? Or what is the case for investing in
the STI ETF? So in the world of investments, if you look at portfolios of investors, retail include, in particular, there is what you call home bias.
Mm.
Right? Because I'm in Singapore, I'm familiar with OCBC, it's all in the STI index, therefore I buy more. Mm. But what we are trying to help guide our clients is that do not put all your eggs into one basket. Most of our property or wealth are already here. So for your bankable, tradable assets and funds, buy the best of class companies all over the world. And these days it's very easy to buy. It's by just a few clicks on the web, right? You get
on your phone even.
On your phone. So there is a place for STI. And if you look at the constituents, it's very important when you buy an index, look at the constituents.
Yeah.
In the case of Singapore, what do you want to buy in Singapore in the context of the world? Yeah. So we kind of look at the market as one market, which is global.
Yeah.
I don't kind of single out or STI is one market, S&P. No, I look at it as one single market. And how do I build my portfolio? The way to build it is, number one, I want to buy income generators,
companies that give me dividend sustainable. Where do I find them? Singapore is a fertile ground.
Yes, yes.
Right? The banking stocks, REITs give you a very nice 5 to 6% sustainable dividends. So I want that in my overall portfolio. And then I want to also buy long-term growth companies. And inevitably, you will navigate towards US because tech companies. Yeah. So that's how you kind of pick the best choice of companies. So we call that income generators. We call them secular growth. So STI would be, I guess, a blended. But it's very country focused.
Yeah.
Move away from that. Think about it from where the world is your opportunity set.
Don't invest in STIDF. You can get some of that and then some of other stuff as well.
That's right.
That's very fair. Yeah.
There is a value in every stock that you buy. And how do you calculate the value? It's really, they call it the intrinsic value, right? It's really if you are owning a company which has a certain positioning in the industry, and because of its strong brands, it can generate a certain, I would say, annual cash flows, right? Profits. So if you do math on this string or series of cash flows, then you get a certain value for the stock. So unless, of course, you are not analyzing the right stock or the right company, some companies can go missing and, you know, become irrelevant. That's when it becomes zero, right? But S&P is an index of 500 stocks, and these are the most competitive companies out there in the world. So don't think...
won't happen, is it?
I don't think it would ever happen. I mean, history is not suggesting not that at all.
What do you think of something like the Russell 1000?
So the Russell 1000 is mainly smaller companies, right? And there are 1,000 names there. Again, there will be some that...
Drop off.
But there will always be winners, and there will be some of these smaller companies that become bigger and bigger, and then they would then find a place in the S&P 500. You know.
So just now you mentioned about some indexes that haven't outperformed the bond market. Like, what are some examples?
So if you look at Nikkei, right, the Japanese stock market, since the peak at 38,000 in the late 1980s, where are we today? I think we're below 38,000. So you would be better off actually owning bonds in Japan, right? So that's a good example. And of course, some emerging market economies, you know, the markets are also not doing as well as if you're holding the bonds of these companies in the emerging market. Because at the end of the day, when you own an investment, that company that you buy must create value for its customers and grow that franchise, right? So as a shareholder, you are an owner of the company, right? So then you would benefit. But you have to seek out the most competitive companies in your investment portfolio.
Actually, based on that, I have a follow-up question. One of the stupid questions that I have also. So we talk about intrinsic value that companies have, right? If I'm a trader or investor, right? Am I actually contributing anything when I invest? Is there a value in me contributing to society or whatever?
So you may not see it, you know, like if you're an engineer, you know, building a infrastructure, a bridge or whatever, but there is a place certainly for long-term investors, right? Long-term investors, they determine the fair value of the company. So if they like a certain company and they feel it's not reflective of the share price, they would buy. And that will bring the share price up to what they think is the fair value. Now, the indirect contribution of long-term investors to this world economy is that if the company sees that its share price is doing well, he has the currency to sell more shares and increase its capital, right? To either do more capex, grow their business, expand, you know, their business globally, or even do acquisitions. So in that way, it helps the economy to be more competitive because now you have a stronger player.
So it's like if the company is doing well, then long-term investors basically are rewarding the company for doing that because it gives them that capability to do more with their track record of doing well as a company, yes. Basically. And so, of course, then giving back to the world.
Yeah, so that. So they will be rewarded with a higher share price. And with that higher share price, they could raise more capital to do more expansion. And that's going to create jobs.
Right. So on that note, so if I'm a company and I have some shares that are available for retail investors to participate in, right? It seems sometimes to me, right, that whether the stock price go up or down, because unless I sell or I sell right more to capitalize on the share price going up, actually does that even help the company when the share price goes up?
So in the short term, I don't think companies are too focused on the day-to-day movements.
Mm.
But for sure, they will be focused on the longer-term trajectory of their share price because of the reasons I've just said. You know, a strong share price, a high share price allows them a lot of flexibility to grow their business and to hire more people, right? Short-term, there are a lot of movements, there are a lot of noises. Now, so to that point about traders or short-term do they contribute to the real economy?
Mm.
Indirectly, yes, because when you have a lot of excitement over a share and there's a lot of volume in that particular share on a, trading for a long
daily basis
of time, it has liquidity, and liquidity is useful because it helps the bigger boys to be able to transact in the market for your particular stock. When you have a lot of liquidity at the same time, you tend to trade at a premium, we call it, over other stocks that do not have liquidity.
Liquidity just means that if I want to sell immediately, I can find somebody that want to buy.
Correct.
All it means.
Correct.
In this case.
So we have seen some cases whereby, a company, that is operating in a country A, but when it comes to, it's a private company, but when it comes to listing and become a public company, it lists somewhere else. Why? Because that somewhere else has a deeper liquidity.
Yep.
Broader market
right.
And commands a higher valuation.
Mm.
You could see like NASDAQ has always been a focus for such kind of companies.
Yeah. There's a prestige of it, is it?
The prestige. And also, really, if you look at US, that there is an institutional pool of funds, right?
Yeah.
And they therefore can give a premium valuation.
Right. So even on a short-term basis, when traders are trading purely for the sake of short-term profit, you said that there's also some indirectly some contribution because they are playing their part in sort of valuating something, right? By reflecting sort of the current market value. Is that then only possible if the people, short-term or long-term, right, is aware of what they're doing? Because like we said, that's because of democratizing of information also, anyone can go and write a post, And if it's marketed well, even if it's nonsense, maybe it will be picked up. And then in that case, that's not really truth, right?
So
but maybe I'm overvaluing truth.
So maybe, like GameStop.
Yeah, maybe marketing is part of the thing. Like, how do you square that?
So it's a discovery.
Yeah.
Price, they call it price discovery. Obviously, when you buy or you have a bullish view on a stock, there is always someone who is bearish.
Mm.
That's why there's a market, right? A buy and a sell. So all this short-term trading helps in the price discovery of the underlying fundamentals and how it should be priced in the long term.
I guess another thing like happened in the 70s or 80s, I can't remember, is that companies started to move towards tying CEO performance
to the share price.
Yeah. Say CEO or COE, CEO performance to share price.
COE is the car one.
So like a high share price might seem like an endorsement of what the CEO is doing and that might actually allow the CEO to do more of what they are doing.
Right.
Alignment, alignment of interest. So as a CEO, as a management staff, you are paid options, right? So it is in your interest that you also do well for the company so that the share price reflects that and you are directly a beneficiary of that because you are compensated with stocks.
Yeah.
What's your view on this thing called shareholder capitalism?
Okay, so that's activism, right?
Yeah. Wait, can you describe what shareholder capitalism
is when the company, pursues profits above all else and a lot of it is short-term profits.
So profits to please the shareholder.
Yeah, so you put the shareholder's interest first. Right. Like the main purpose of the company is to make money. So that's
opposed to what though?
As opposed to, let's say something like, their name is called stakeholder capitalism where they start to also, okay, other than shareholders, they also consider the needs of the staff, the community, the customers.
Wow, okay, so that's your stakeholders.
Yeah, so there's stakeholder capitalism and then there's shareholder capitalism.
Right, okay.
So there's an argument that shareholder capitalism actually has made the world like a very unequal place, a very unpleasant place, and it's kind of like profit at all costs, so therefore like with huge damage to the environment and living conditions or even wages.
Okay.
What's
so based on your definition of shareholder
capitalism.
Capitalism and stakeholder capitalism, then obviously the former is more short term. Mm. I need to push up my earnings this quarter.
Mm.
You know, because so I want
capital appreciation.
I want to cash out my whatever employee stock options.
Mm.
But the markets are over time will actually see through all of this. And really the best long-term strategy is for you to be a stakeholder.
I guess that's why there's a recent interest on ESG also, because ESG is effectively
stakeholder capitalism. Yeah,
because
right,
the idea is that you can, let's say you're a company, you want to cut as much cost as possible. So you cut the wages of your employees and do so low to maximize profit in the short term. But in the long term, all your good people leave. So that is considered shareholder capitalism. Mm. But if you consider your employees like needs, pay them well long enough, then they will stay for long term and hopefully they will bring the productivity up for your company.
That's right. So in a similar vein, ESG, right? Climate friendly kind of policies will in the long term benefit you as an owner of that company, right? Shareholder of the company. Why? Because it's really the democratization of the entire market.
Mm.
So today, all things being equal between two companies, you know, the fundamentals and valuation of two companies being equal, you want to buy the one with a higher ESG rating.
Yeah.
Why? Because there's more money, in fact, a lot of money that goes to mandates that favor companies that practice ESG principles.
But usually all things won't be equal, right? Because to do ESG or sustainable things, usually it comes at a cost.
In the short term, potentially, but the markets see through all of these, right?
Right.
And the markets are also, you know, really who drives the market is individual, institutional investors. Mm.
Right.
And these are important things to them.
I like the way you refer to the market. It seems like this, like, I don't know, primordial beast that under the current of the noise on top, there is something that always persists and is very fundamental. It's a bit like what Remy was telling me about, like, when you look at, like, how market hype and noise sometimes drive these spikes in the thing, if you just zoom out long enough, you will see that actually the overall market is a very steady thing, you know? So beneath what we see, also the market also has, like, two facets, like short term and long term.
Yeah.
And the one you describe a lot of time when you say the markets will see through all that is that long term, almost like a tortoise versus, like, I don't know, a very erratic creature, like a rabbit, you know.
It's like a Warren Buffett quote here again, you know, something like, in the short term, the market is a voting machine.
Right.
In the long term, it is a weighing scale.
Right. Weighing scale meaning like I will.
So you weigh like the value
of the company.
Right. Short term you just vote and see like it's a popularity contest.
Right.
But only long term the results will show. So I think that's the thing behind it.
I see.
So there's a lot of like accusation of greenwashing in the ESG space.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Again, the market will see through it.
You just think it, so.
Yeah. So
don't care about it, is it?
No. I think it's in the spotlight. Regulators are coming in to, you know, to test if your green initiatives are really greenwashing or is it genuine.
Mm.
I mean, some asset managers got into trouble because they were marketing products that has this certainty of green, you know, buying into green companies, but these are not really what they profess to be. So, the regulators are coming in as well, and the market will sort itself out. I mean, if you're not saying what you really are, doing what you're really saying, then the market will penalize you.
Right.
Okay, so with that in mind, right, so there's the regular S&P 500 index fund. There's also like a S&P 500 ESG index fund. So what I might guess you might say, is that it is okay to buy the ESG variant, or are there like serious trade-offs that you have to consider?
Okay, I've not looked at the ESG version of the S&P 500, but there are a number of considerations before you buy a certain product, right? Say in relation to this two index that you mentioned, you need to look at the liquidity as well. You need to look at the expense ratio if you are buying the exchange traded fund of the S&P 500 or the ESG version. Does the latter, you know, the ESG has a higher expense ratio? Because over time, management fees can eat up total returns.
Right.
So we've been talking about like equities quite a lot. But what do you think of real estate?
Oh, Singapore property in particular.
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes. Because it seems like, especially in our parent generation, that Singapore property never lose one.
As far as I know, and as long as I know, Singapore property has been in the bull market.
Because land is scarce here, is that
one? I think land is scarce is one factor. The other one is, you know, our founders and the government has done a tremendous job in, you know, in moving us from a third world country into a first world.
Oh, sure,
so yeah. Obviously, on that progression, the real estate market would have to reflect, you know, first world kind of
valuation. Yeah, yeah.
So, is it still a good asset class to have? Well, as long as we are able to adapt ourselves to the new world, you know, the digital world, as long as we are successful with this global talent hunt that every country is now pursuing, you know, I think our prices here, property prices here will be supported and it will rise with inflation.
Many elder Singaporeans put a huge chunk of the net worth into the HDB. What do you think are the implications of that?
I think that has served us as a country very well, right? A lot of people have their nest egg in the apartments and the HDB flats that they own. Again, like what I said earlier, don't put all your eggs into one basket. If you have excess savings, then invest into, you know, the world, the diversify. Best of class companies to diversify away from just, you know, a home buyer's kind of approach.
And what do you think is like a reasonable amount for your total net worth to be in your residential property?
I would imagine, you know, not more than 60%.
Huh.
Is it more than 60%?
I think right now, yes.
Okay.
I think for, obviously for that people who are just starting out, right?
Yeah, of course.
But I think over time, as you know, accumulate savings, then try not to have too focused or too much into the same asset class, same market.
Yeah. So actually zooming out a bit, right? Students always ask me this, like, what if I just don't invest? Yeah.
Okay, so historically, cash deposits always lag inflation.
In terms of growth, is it?
Yeah, so you lose purchasing power on the deposits because price of goods will go up faster than your interest rate on your deposit. So that would be the opportunity cost.
But is it then, okay, then is it recommended for everybody to invest? Because we did talk about the idea of like buying stuff at below intrinsic value, for example, so that you participate in the market as a part of the market. But for retail, I think I can speak for most lay people, like me included, that I don't think most people can be investors in that way. Like, I don't want to go and read company report every evening before I sleep, you know?
You don't need to specifically buy individual stock. You can buy into funds. But obviously, you need to have cash. Cash is an asset class within the overall portfolio construct, right?
Yeah.
But if you have excess cash and you really don't need to draw on that excess cash, then you put that cash to work. And now things are normalizing so that now you're getting a lot more return, you know, through bonds, through dividend stocks. And the power of compounding is very powerful. It's magical.
Right.
You know, you can start with X amount and say your fund manager, you know, can generate you 7% a year. You double in 10 years. You quadruple in 20 years. Eightfold in 30 years.
Right.
What about people who just can't take like the short term volatility? Like let's say I put 100k in, right? Then I see, oh my god, 98k, I have a heart attack. Then I pass away. What will you feel if someone...
That's a bit drastic, really.
Okay.
Maybe pass away.
Maybe don't pass away. Yeah. Maybe in a...
very stressed, lah.
Yeah, very stressed. Yeah. What should someone like that do?
So, like I said, cash is a expression. It's an asset class. And I think a lot of clients, investors, they tend to look at just their investment holding. Try to look at things on an overall basis. Okay, cash plus investment holding, how much did that value drop by with this market crash? Then it would help,
It's a very CIO kind of answer, which is great.
But what if they do not want to think, like, they can't take any short term?
Then cannot, must learn. Right?
No, what are the options, right? What do you feel is like the best option?
As of now, there are some opportunities in bonds.
Yeah.
Bond funds, that invest in short-dated bonds that will give you a higher yield than fixed deposits. But fixed deposit makes sense, as well. So for people who cannot take any market volatility, then I would say cash and short-term bond funds.
How about something like a CPF, SA?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to park money. At 4%, right, SA, and it's government risk, makes a lot of sense. Although, given where interest rates have gone up this year, there are also other compelling opportunities besides CPF.
Such as? You got a...
Short-dated bonds, like I mentioned, do give you 4 to 5% today. Yeah.
Let's say like somebody watches this video, right, then they want to Google something, like they want to Google like the said short-dated bond.
Oh, you're saying which short-dated bond? I just want to know what the
what
bond
would they Google?
I can't be...
I can't be promoting
my fund.
It's okay.
Right, yeah, right. But increasingly, yeah. I think there will be more and more of these portfolio solutions.
So
given
just,
that rates are all have normalized.
So they just Google short-dated bond and something should come up. Is it fair to say that? Okay. Are you uncomfortable?
No, yeah, I'm not uncomfortable.
Oh, are you being nice?
Short duration bond is one way to help you, search out. You can also Google. Yeah, you can Google bond funds.
I mean, it's understandable because we sometimes talk to people, so a lot of times like people just ask us for what is the stock that I should buy, but it's not like that. Also, it's like what do you want it for?
Yeah.
And it's more like you talk about the mindset.
You nail it on the head. So. Portfolio construction is very important. So when clients ask you, hey, should I buy this stock? Okay, what do you want the stock for?
How long?
Is it an income generator? Yeah. In which case, then you buy into dividend yielding stocks, right? And in today's world, in Singapore, REITs and bank stocks gives you a nice dividend. Are you buying it for long-term growth? So ask these questions.
Yeah.
And how does this, whatever security, sit in your overall portfolio? Is it 25% of your portfolio, in which case that's taking too much of a risk.
Right.
So these are important questions to ask the whoever who's interested to know why I should be buying this or that. Yeah.
Right. So what do you think is the responsible average level of due diligence, the average person who has no passion in looking up this stuff, what should they on a basic level do in terms of like managing or looking at their finances? If I just either use a robo or I do index fund. Do you think that is enough for a retail, just a normal person? The average person who don't care? Because sometimes you all talk about this like bonds and like short data, all that. I also start to blank out because it becomes very technical very fast for some people, no?
I think, a good, I would say a good way to build a portfolio is for most retail investors, it's not to buy individual stocks or bonds, it's to buy funds. I think the other observation that I can think of is a lot of investors tend to buy individual bonds. And guess what? If I were to buy 5 individual bonds, or if I buy a fund and underneath the fund has 100 bonds, guess what? The return on both strategy is the same. But you can imagine if there is a default. That's why you need diversification. Don't buy into individual bond names. Rather for retail investors, buy into a bond fund. Right. Now, what do you find? How do you choose a bond fund? That's when maybe the advisor, the bank can help you with it.
Right.
But if I remember correctly, because bond fund, it's not exactly a bond, right? It's a collection of bonds.
That's
sometimes
right.
The price of the bond fund can actually fall, and that causes a loss on your end.
Yeah.
So what are some tips about that?
So if you are buying bonds, they are also subjected to price movements, right? If interest rates go up, the bond price come down. So then the bond fund price will also come down. But we know that as long as there is no bankruptcy, that bond will gravitate towards par.
Par is what?
Par is 100, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So normally, say I'm a company and I want to borrow money from the market. So I issue bonds at a certain rate. Say, for example, I issue at 4%. That means I borrow at 4%. And I borrow, say, $1 million over 5 years. So for the next 5 years, I have to pay 4% as a company, right? Now, that 100 price can actually go up and down. Say, for example, interest rates start to move up very quickly after I borrowed the money. Then the bond price could come down to 90.
Because the new bonds are now worth more.
Yeah.
Correct. Because to the investor, actually, I can buy something else that is 5%. But when you came up with your bond, it was 4%. So it has to adjust to that 5%. Therefore, that price would have come down. But if this company is a strong company, it will not default. This 90 will always go back to 100 at maturity. So you still get your 4%.
Right.
And then at the end of 5 years, you get 100.
So as long as you hold for a long term,
hold it until
you won't lose money if you buy a bond.
That is of good quality in terms of credit. Credit rating. Obviously, for you to be paid 4% when the fixed deposit is 2% means there is embedded risk. Right?
Yeah.
You are paid higher, right? No. For no higher return, there's higher risk. Now, how do you ameliorate or reduce that risk? You must have many, many bonds.
You don't just buy
one bond, because that one bond pays you 4% and it goes bankrupt, you lose everything. If you have 100 bonds in that portfolio, so sway one of the bonds default. You're still okay.
Because there's a very popular thing where they say, oh, don't play to not lose, you play to win. You know, but in this case, like sometimes it also pays to just be a bit more cautious and to have some protection so you don't lose as bad.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. You must be able to stay in the game. Markets are like that. You know, if you have no more
ammo
and you are leveraged, you have to, you are margin caught, you call it, you have forced to sell, then that's it. Game over. But
game over.
If you have ability to stay in a game, you can ride through all this volatility and you will come out better or a winner. So how do you win the game in investment?
Long-term game.
And because at the end of the day, you're buying very good companies with credible, growing business models, revenue models. No one knows the timing of the market up and down. But when you hold on to these, over time, these shares or these bonds will do well.
I also see that because everybody started jumping in in the past few years, they're exposed, or the market has, the news has always been talking about very high return kind of stuff. Were there any times in your lifetime in exposure to these markets and stuff where that sort of level of hype has happened when it comes to young people for the first time dipping their toes in the market? Then it's my expectation is so out of whack. Basically, don't have this long-term kind of perspective. Has that happened before?
There's nothing new under the sun, right? So in every bubble, you will have investors just going after the hottest stock, right? I remember back in 1999, we were launching some portfolios to the public market. But these are quite diversified portfolios globally.
Is pre-DBS or?
Pre-DBS.
Okay.
But every customer that the bank tries to reach out to, potential customer, say, no, I want technology funds. Because then it was the internet bubble.
You said 1999. So this is after Asian financial crisis, just before the dot-com thing.
Yeah, 1999, right? So that was the hottest thing then, right? So everyone wants just technology
stocks. Dot-com things. Give me dot-com things.
Yeah,
right.
Correct. So in a similar vein, I think every now and then you do see this kind of exuberance.
So nothing new lah, actually.
Nothing new under the sun, yeah.
So would you say this like crypto stuff, like it rhymes with the dot-com boom last time? Because for us, it's very new, because like it's our first time really seeing this. So for us, it's like, wow, this kind of thing. Also, but then you look back into all this, like, you know, the tulip bulb thing last tulip time, mania, you know, that happened, you know, and then you're like, happened before. But we've never seen it before.
Right.
We're not experienced enough. You know, right. So maybe I think 10 years, when the kids then, wow, this thing happened, it was like, well, that was the same as that.
Yeah.
Dot-com also
not dissimilar, yeah.
It's so exuberant.
Yeah, so you remember, I don't know, you may have read some literature. There was this, a lot of dot-com companies like the pets.com,
which
never came back, right? But at the same time, there were some dot-com, which is very, very credible, right? Amazon.com.
Yes, yes.
So always seek out companies with that unique, growing business models.
Yeah, that's the thing also, because like, I also, not saying I'm endorsing crypto or whatever, you know, like, but the underlying thing behind crypto, like blockchain and stuff, I also think like, well, the dot-com bubble happened, and it's not like dot-coms are gone, they are still around. It's just that it was severely overvalued at that time. So I'm also thinking whether crypto is like that, where some things will be around. It's just that the level of exuberance that we witnessed this past 2 years, just basically it culled all the bad ones, like, you know?
Mm.
Then maybe some will survive. I don't know.
I think it's worth saying like Amazon fell 90% at the dot-com bubble, then slowly came up to what it is today. So I think if you're investing in crypto, it's very important to be able to survive the time where your investment goes back up.
Yeah,
because sometimes if you cannot survive the short term, you cannot survive the long term.
Mm.
Part of surviving the long term means surviving the short term as well.
Mm-hmm.
I got one last question for you. I think it's about inflation. So inflation in Singapore is really high. I think today the news came out was around 5% core inflation. And if you look at many of these bonds and financial products out there, they're not exactly... more than 5%.
Mm.
So some people feel like, you know, it's pointless because, you know, I can't even beat inflation. What do you got to say to that?
So financial products, they always discount ahead. And a good example is the US. You know, inflation is 8%, but the bonds are 5%. Why? Because the bonds are forecasting that going forward, inflation will drop. Not wrong. If you look at, they analyze the headline inflation, at least half of that 8% is due to energy, commodity prices, global supply chain related kind of reasons. And we do see some normalization of that. So headline will drop based on that. Also the high base effect from this year. The market kind of put a value to it, a certain interest rate, a forward interest rate to it. So it's better off than holding cash.
So what I'm hearing is you can't beat inflation now, like this current spike of inflation, but you can beat like the future inflation, which is most likely to be down like to 2%, just regular time.
And really there is no alternative. So if you don't invest in that bond that gives you 4-5%, then what? Cash deposit, 2%. The markets always are forward indicator, you know, the pricing of the financial instruments. And you're right to say inflation is 5. We should try to seek out higher income generating assets. And there are pockets of it here and there, you know, but probably not in that region of 5% because the markets are always forward thinking.
Well, on that note, I think we want to thank you for your humility, your candor, you know, and even bothering to come down to our Rabat startup office, you know. So it's been great. Thank you so much.
Most welcome.
We had a lot of fun. Hope it was fun for you also. In case we are unable to get any more guests because of the way we treated Wei Fook, and this is our last episode, thank you very much for supporting our YouTube channel all this while. Thanks very much for potentially being our last guest. If there's anything else you want us to talk about, put in the comments. Otherwise, this might be the last video you see from us. So thank you very much. Stay woke, salary man.
Yes, thank you. We had a great great run, and I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Wei Fook.
Most welcome. Hope you learned a lesson or two for all your 400,000 followers.
Yeah.